Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Matt Wood, director of FedSoc Films. In 1787, delegates from the newly independent states met in Philadelphia to amend the Articles of Confederation. But by the end of the convention, a whole new constitution was written. Out of the three main articles of this newly formed constitution, Article 2 dealt with the executive branch, aka the President of the United States. Our film, American Cincinnatus, chronicles one of the biggest decisions by America's first president by exploring the parallels between founding farmer turned founding father, George Washington, and the Roman statesman Cincinnatus, who, like Washington, was a successful general and politician who gave up power and returned to life as a citizen. But there's an important question we didn't have time to fully explore in the film. How much did the assumption that George Washington would be the first president influence or shape the drafting of Article II? To answer this question and others, we have three experts with us today. Dr. Matthew Spaulding, the Vice President of Washington Operations at Hillsdale College, Dr. Jeffrey Morrison, Professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University, and Dr. W.B. Allen, Emeritus Dean and Professor at Michigan State University. Dr. Spaulding and Dr. Morrison were both featured in our film, American Cincinnatus, and interestingly enough, all three of today's guests are longtime friends, so this should be an interesting conversation. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
And good to join you.
Yes, Matt, thank you very much. Delighted to be back.
Very good. Well, Dr. Allen, first question to you. Was your interest in George Washington, was that what originally connected you to Dr. Spaulding and Dr. Morrison?
Well, certainly it was a common interest in George Washington that introduced Jeffrey Morrison and me through correspondence. I very much appreciated him at the stage in his career when he was launching out that he recognized that he could openly contact me and seek information, and we've had a fruitful exchange ever since. As for Dr. Spaulding, it wasn't a common interest in George Washington. It was that was something, of course, I had developed long before he entered into his professional pathways, but he entered into them at the very institution at which I was, of course, on the faculty, and so it was a natural gravitation.
Very good. And Dr. Spaulding or Dr. Morrison, anything to add to that story?
I'll actually just to follow up with Dr. Allen, of course, was being being humble. But I was a student and loved my studies with some excellent professors. But Dr. Allen did two things for me. One is my original interest in Washington was actually a side interest in the sense that all the other graduate students that I was studying there with were doing these analyses of Madison and Hamilton and I originally had this thought that, well, maybe Washington will be more easier and more straightforward, but little did I know. And then I started. Dr. Allen, I put together this wonderful reader, which is still the classic one-volume reader of Washington's. And so I picked that up, and it kind of went from there. But Dr. Allen is one that put Washington in the place of all my studies about the founding. So I'm both thankful to him, but also, he kind of pushed me on my way, and I've studied Washington ever since. Based on all of that. So.
And I myself would echo what Dr. Spaulding just said. And Dr. Allen's one-volume collection is still my favorite one-volume on Washington. I consult it regularly. It was at my side as I was writing my own book on Washington. And I believe we first met when we had Dr. Allen out to the Air Force Academy, where I was a young assistant professor. And it was perhaps a little forward of me. He was being delicate when he said that I reached out to him, maybe a little forwardly, but I've just been honored to have him as a colleague of sorts and an acquaintance for these years, and we've had him back. I also helped to run a program for the federal government at Georgetown this summer. We've been honored to have him come and address our fellows there. So it's been decades now, and I've learned a great deal from him, sort of the elder statesman of Washington scholars.
Well, Mr. Wood, if you'll permit me to intervene, because these wonderful scholars have been excessive in their characterization, I must take the time to say that they have both proved themselves to be commanding scholars of George Washington, quite independently of any influence they received from me. And more importantly, my introduction to Washington was quite by accident. Theirs was by intelligent design. So if you want to contrast evolution and intelligent design, I think they come out ahead.
Wonderful. Well, we are all lucky to have you, Dr. Allen, and Dr. Morrison and Dr. Spaulding on this. This is going to be a great episode. So, Dr. Allen, I'd like to ask the next question to you, which is, you wrote a book titled George Washington, America's First Progressive. How do you think Washington was a progressive, and how did that influence how he governed?
Well, of course, there's nothing very subtle about that, is there? He's the first politician in our history, at least, of course, as we record from the founding, who actually referred to himself as a progressive. Therefore, he was the first progressive. But as to the question of what he means by being progressive, I think it means nothing less than fully embracing the promise of self-government and expecting, as he explicitly said, that to produce an era in human history of flourishing, a human proficiency. I think that is what he meant when he said he was a progressive, that the era of rights, the guarantee of rights, the security of self-government would prove to be the greatest blessing for humankind.
Very good. Fascinating. And Dr. Spaulding, you've written numerous books on Washington and the founders as well, including The Founder's Almanac, a practical guide to the notable events, greatest leaders, and most eloquent words of the American founding. What are some or one of your favorite and what you consider most eloquent words from George Washington?
Well, I think there are many. I would preface it by saying this, which is that the my own study of Washington, as I've studied him more over the years, has really found that I think some of his most eloquent things are found in letters here and there, which is to say that he, of course, has some wonderful, you know, greater, longer pieces. I did my first book on Washington on the farewell address, and my dissertation on the farewell address. So I would put that in that category. His circular address has some wonderful passages in it, but really some of his letters, one of my favorite is the one he writes to Catherine McCullough Graham. It's one of the most introspective letters of any great statesman, but really explains Washington's own role he played in the founding. His statesmanship, unlike, say, those who write long books or extensive things to explain their political philosophy, his politics, his statesmanship, his greatness is really seen in command, which is his life is fully in command. And so you see it in the letters he writes, the decisions he makes, the in many ways, sometimes even the asides are these wonderful remarks that come out in commanding his troops. So I think it's part of understanding Washington is seeing that you have to look at him differently to see his greatness as the founder that you would perhaps other figures.
I suppose a reason to treasure the somewhat lost art of writing letters to each other. Well, I think that's a great answer and great insight. So, Dr. Morrison, to conclude this little section about books, one of your books on George Washington, titled The Political Philosophy of George Washington, where do you see the overlap between Washington's political philosophy and perhaps the political philosophy that shaped Article II?
Well, I'm going to answer that, but I'd like to jump in, if I may, and just say a couple of things about what I think are some of Washington's most significant writings. And like Dr. Spaulding, I'd say letters. And I think the letter to the Hebrew congregation in 1790 is one of the most beautiful and eloquent statements of the difference between religious toleration and religious liberty. It's concise. It's lovely prose. It's inspiring. He says to those Hebrews, the new government, you have nothing to fear from the new government. Your religious liberty is secure even without a Bill of Rights. And all the government asks of you is that you be good citizens. And the Constitution gives to bigotry no sanction, he says, and to persecution no sanction as well. It's a lovely, lovely piece of statesmanship. And I believe he wrote it entirely himself. Another is a letter to the Marquis de Lafayette. You know, Washington had no children in the flesh. And so he tended to adopt these younger men like Lafayette, like Hamilton, adopt in an informal sense. And I find he could unburden himself to Lafayette in ways that he couldn't perhaps to other men. And there are just poignant letters where he's obviously aching for Mount Vernon or longing to go back to a peaceful life of farming, a la Cincinnatus. And again, some of those are the most eloquent statements. And he talks about, he quotes the scripture about beating swords into plowshares and so on. And Washington was a remarkably good writer. And we tend to think of him as kind of a big dumb jock, if you will. Looked good in a uniform, perhaps commanding on the battlefield, but not the best politician, not the brightest. Turns out he had a great facility with language that got better over time. And also he had a very, very keen practical intelligence. So those things tend to come out, I think, in these letters. Now, as to Article 2, to answer your question more directly, Article 2 in Washington's political philosophy. His political philosophy was simple but profound, I think, and coherent. And I was always taught in philosophy class that coherence is a mark of intelligence. It's something desirable in a philosophy. And Washington had a coherent and tight political philosophy about the young United States. Article 2, Washington was an executive by nature. By nature, and then again, even by second nature through his career in the military and even elsewhere. So he tended to be a vigorous chief executive. He tended to side, I believe, with Alexander Hamilton in certain instances. For example, may the president issue a proclamation of neutrality, even though that power is not delegated or enumerated in Article 2. Washington agreed with Hamilton, yes, or concluded, perhaps alongside Hamilton, yes, he may, and did. Is the chief executive to be a vigorous and energetic officer? Yes, he is. So I think Washington's nature and also his, we might say, more generous reading of the constitutional text come out in his two terms, reluctant terms, I might add, as president of the United States.
Wonderful. Well, to that end, I'd like to play a short snippet from our film, American Cincinnatus, and this part deals with the idea of Article 2 and Washington. So take a listen.
So at the founding, one of the visions of the executive power was that it needed to be vigorous, that it needed to be sufficiently strong, invested with enough power that it would be able to counterbalance the other two branches of the federal government.
The founders were trying to achieve a balanced government, a constitutional government, but one that had a strong executive.
They had solace in the fact that as they were getting this new government up on its feet, up and running, that George Washington would be the one exerting that influence.
So, Dr. Morrison, part of what inspired this episode was that you actually take a little bit of a different view from what is mentioned in the film, which is the idea that, as Judge Andrew Oldham said, the founders took solace in knowing that Washington would be the first president. So can you expand on your view and tell us why your friends and colleagues may be missing something or seeing it differently than you?
Well, I will, but I do it with a little trepidation because I'm going to have to play devil's advocate. And I don't know if I should do that in the presence of the Reverend Dr. Allen. I don't want to advocate for the devil, but it's a view. I know it is conventional wisdom amongst scholars, amongst perhaps the average person, that that George Washington was in everyone's mind when Article II was being drafted and then ratified. And I suppose there is some truth to that. But it has always seemed implausible to me that those framers, those men who claimed to be trying to create a government that would last for ages, as they said, that would govern millions yet unborn, would hang on such a slender reed as the life of one man, all of these powers that are either explicit or implicit in Article II. They have very recently just concluded a war for independence, just 4 years prior, in which they threw off a king, an executive, that they called a tyrant in their Declaration of Independence. It just seems implausible to me that they would grant the new president powers simply because George Washington would be the first holder of that office. So what evidence is there that they did so? Almost everyone points to one letter and one letter only, from Pierce Butler of South Carolina to, I believe, a relative of his in England, in which he says, entre nous, between us. I don't believe the powers of the presidency would have been so great had not the members of that convention cast their eyes on Washington as president. What's the context of that? Pierce Butler is, he's become disillusioned with the Washington administration. He thinks that the Constitution has been hijacked by Alexander Hamilton. He's kind of an anti-federalist at this point, to use a slightly anachronistic word. And that seems to be the sum of the evidence, or most of it anyway. And it just seems to me out of character for Madison and others who are so forward-thinking and who know their ancient history and how easy it is for Rome to go from being a republic to a depraved empire, or for Athens to do that. So I find it implausible that they would have risked so much on the life of one man.
Dr. Allen, I'll let you respond first, if you'd like to go ahead.
I certainly would. I must hasten to assure Dr. Morrison that he has not sinned.
Well, I'm relieved. I'm relieved to hear it.
Forgiven.
For I, in fact, agree.
At least not a mortal sin. Yeah.
Neither even a venial sin. For I agree with him completely. I think that conventional wisdom has always been mistaken. Mistaken both about Washington and about Washington's colleagues in the convention. To be sure, Washington was looked to instinctively as the first president. So let's check that box and say correct. But does that mean the design of the presidency occurred in the way it did because he was expected? We must check that box, no. For Washington himself plays a significant role in designing that. His correspondence with his colleagues prior to the convention, setting forth the dimensions of the new government, make clear that he wants that energetic executive, not because he's going to hold the office, but because he sees it as essential to build the bulwarks of union that are necessary to keep the country together. It was Washington who declared, before the Constitutional Convention is an assured reality, that influence is no government. And he did this, mm-hmm. of course, in his letter to his nephew. And he means that. That's not a throwaway line. And therefore, you could scarcely expect him to endorse constructing a government based on influence. What he wanted was quite obviously, because he repeats it so often, a government in which the rule of law could prevail in the hearts of the citizens. And Dr. Morrison was quite correct to say he was an executive by nature. But I must add to that, what I think is the most important thing is that he was a citizen by preference. He was an executive by nature, therefore, who, through the war and thereafter, confined his native executive abilities, subordinating them to the task of raising citizenship to the higher standard. He thought that was the condition of justice, citizenship itself, and the recognition, therefore, of the superior authority of the citizens in a self-governing republic. He could diminish his own stature precisely because he saw diminishing his own stature as essentially to securing the constitutional dynamic that they sought to create. Therefore, does it make sense to say they created it because of the dynamism of his powerful executive impression? That runs counter to everything they worked for.
And Dr. Spalding, where do you fall on this issue?
Well, I will be a member of the choir, I suppose. So broadly speaking, I would agree with all the things that have been said here. I think it is kind of a straw man to say that, you know, he, from this one quote, shaped Article II. Having said that, I'll point out a couple of things I think we have not put on the table that I've come to see an important way in which I think Washington's role played a decisive way in which it actually shapes what becomes the presidency. We have to kind of back up a little bit. When Jeffrey was giving his background about Washington, it made me think of the great letter when Thomas Jefferson is asked about Washington, and he says, "I think I know his character," but then of course begins by saying he was no Bacon, Newton, or Locke, in a very Jeffersonian way, with that little snide remark. But he then goes on to say that
not one of the three greatest men who ever lived without exception. As Jefferson says,
right. But of course, you know, but not counting himself, of course. But then he goes on to say, but Washington was what he had was prudence, which is to say that he recognizes that he might not have been one of Jefferson's favorite political philosophers, but he had this other thing, this characteristic, the central virtue of the classical virtue of the statesman. There was something about Washington, I think, that really was looked to by the other founders that was crucially important. And we see that play out, often overlooked in these in a conversation about the considerations of the presidency, because we often focus on the fact that at the convention, the main debate was about the legislative branch and representation. The presidency kind of is kind of late in the game. They come back to this. But they did look to Washington. And the crucial thing here to remember is that Washington had been commander-in-chief. There's several times during his role of commander-in-chief in which he is given by the Continental Congress or the Confederation Congress, absolute powers, at least twice during the Revolution. He's given the powers of almost essentially a Caesar to take control of the Revolution. Which in one famous occasion he uses to gather boats to cross the Delaware, but he gives that power back. There's an episode in which one of his colonels invites him to be king, and he rejects that and writes him back. There's the famous Newburgh episode when his officers threaten to not put down their arms. The Newburgh episode, by the way, something that was being pushed by members of the Congress, which originally included not only Morris, but Hamilton and Madison, at least initially. Madison falls out very quickly, but Hamilton plays around with it a little too much. My point being that Washington's actions in being a very strong commander of the army, but then taking the actions to defend and assure the establishment of constitutional government, by not using his power inappropriately, but by using his power to essentially bring about the convention, I think plays an overwhelming role in how they treated the question of the presidency. I completely agree with the comments before, and especially Dr. Allen's, which is that, of course, they weren't thinking about it in terms of this one person. They weren't betting on this one person, but having said that, I think they did know that was the model, which was a very vigorous executive, which he was by nature, but a vigorous executive. He understood the nature of constitutional government and the rule of law and was willing to do what was needed, exercising the executive power, but then stepping down and taking on his responsibilities as citizens. So I think that I suppose the technical answer is that the role he plays at the convention, although Dr. Allen, I will recall that great essay you wrote. I think it's in one of your books. You kind of go through and talk about how we know Washington voted at the convention based on his the Virginia delegation, right?
Yes.
We know some things about what he thought about the executive, but technically speaking, perhaps not as much as Jeffrey would like to see. But I think the shadow of his role as commander, as military commander, transitioning through the very strength of his persona to the Constitution is an overwhelming model for thinking through the presidency. And I especially have in mind here both Hamilton and Madison, who had around the periphery, in Hamilton's case, a little more directly been involved in the Newburgh debate.
Let me hasten to add a codicil to that, Matt, which I think is important. We must not forget that Washington had demonstrated to his countrymen something which nobody thought possible theretofore, namely that power does not corrupt.
Right.
And that's what Matthew was just illustrating for us. We can show innumerable examples in which he declines the exercise of power, but not to the disadvantage of the country. He uses the power prudently and wisely. But when the Congress says during the war you have absolute power, he still defers. He doesn't exercise it absolutely. He doesn't take it all. And this happens repeatedly. So he's demonstrated something incredibly important. Power needn't corrupt.
Right. I think sometimes if we look for a technical answer, a lawyerly answer, if I might say, on a Federal Society podcast, we might not see that. But sometimes we need to back up and see the larger answer here, which I think is this one about what he modeled. Remember, in the history of government, it's usually the commanding general who takes over power. That's the norm. Washington is the exception, and by being the exception, he really makes possible not only the American presidency, but he really, in my opinion, makes possible the very existence of constitutional government in America.
Hear, hear.
So that ties us back to the story of Cincinnatus that we discussed in the film. And I'm interested if Dr. Morrison or Dr. Spaulding, if you'd like to briefly explain that comparison that we talked about in the film and see maybe what Dr. Allen thinks about the comparison.
Yes, I'd be happy to do it at least first. And so Cincinnatus is a Roman general turned farmer. He's an historical figure. He takes on the aura of myth over the years. And fast forwarding 2,000 years, people were struck both here in America and abroad with the parallels between George Washington and Cincinnatus. Cincinnatus had retired from the army, gone to his farm outside Rome, and was called upon by the Senate to come out of retirement to take the reins of the army, but also the office of dictator, which was an official office that Rome had for a prescribed period of time, 6 months, to help vanquish marauding tribes that were threatening Rome. And he was given 6 months of absolute power. And he, according to legend, more or less dropped the reins of his oxen, put on his toga, and went and took command of the army, vanquished the foe in, I believe, 15 days, something like that. And then, to everyone's astonishment, did not enjoy the perquisites of absolute power as he could have done for the balance of those 6 months, but went right back to his farm. He just wanted to be a farmer. He wanted to protect the liberties of his country, but not to subvert the rule of law or to take that personal power into his own hands longer than he needed it. And so people see immediately the parallels between Washington and Cincinnatus, and then even later figures like Lord Byron. George Gordon calls him the Cincinnatus of the West, and it's an apt comparison, isn't it? It really is. One could hardly script it better than history has done for us.
So I'll make two brief points, and then I actually do want to hear what Dr. Allen has to say. One is, I note that there were, it's not one time that he takes power and steps down, but it's twice, and it's important. That's why I wanted to bring up the Newberg episode, his time as commander in chief. Remember, it's while he's commander of the military that he's twice given the powers of dictator. So that episode, I think, is strikingly important. The other thing, I love the Cincinnatus parallel, but there's a fundamental way in which I think it doesn't actually hold in the way that it's sometimes perceived as.
Yes.
Which is to say that, yes, Washington comes to power and gives it up, and then again comes to power and gives it up, and he wants to be a citizen, to live under his vine and fig tree, as he says. Having said that, I over the years, I've come to the conclusion that I don't think that Washington was this idea of the farmer who just wanted to be at Mount Vernon, resting on his laurels. I think he actually had the soul of a great magnanimous leader, and he knew that he had to do this. He was the only man to do it, and when the time came, he did it. He gave the power back and preserved constitutionalism. But I think the Cincinnatus legend sometimes leaves us with the impression that Washington really wasn't the figure rank we're actually describing here. He actually merely came and did it because he had to. And what he really wanted to do, however, was just go home all the time. And I don't think that fully captures the man.
Well, once again, Dr. Spaulding has anticipated me. I have finally come to the conclusion that the comparison of Washington with Cincinnatus is inapt for substantial reasons, not circumstantial reasons. Cincinnatus preserved a country well-founded. George Washington founded a country.
It's a great
Cincinnati
point.
Was not a founder. His sacrifice was ephemeral, in a manner of speaking. We know how much so because the Vandals would return and Rome would fall. But George Washington did something entirely different. He did, I would say, long to be on his properties, but not on his properties as a kind of escape from the duties and the burdens of citizenship. He wanted to be on his properties in the assurance of citizenship, having produced a nation in which he could securely undertake the labors of citizenship. There's an exchange he had with Thomas Jefferson, 1796, when Jefferson writes a letter to him. By now, of course, Martha would never even admit Jefferson at Mount Vernon again. They're quite on the outs, have been for some time. And Jefferson writes one of those fawning false letters in which he pretends, "I never had any problem with you, George Washington. I have nothing but respect for you." And then goes off to preen himself on his great agricultural knowledge and his scientific bent. Washington writes back to him, ignores completely the fawning apologies for the duplicity that he practiced, Jefferson practiced, and gives Jefferson a real lesson in what it means to be a farmer, and proves that he, Jefferson, is just a dilettante, and George Washington actually knows what it is. And in that one exchange, we can see, yes, he has this virtue of the, not just a farmer, that term is too narrow. He was a real entrepreneur, as all his correspondence indicates, but that he also had a higher ambition that he had realized in founding a nation. If we make one mistake, it is underappreciating the fundamental role in founding this country that George Washington played, the role that Bishop Carroll celebrates in his eulogy just a couple of months after Washington's death. Washington was not just one of the founders. He was the not without which, the one who gave every bit of leverage every other of the founders was able to exercise, because they did it under his aegis.
profound points, Dr. Allen. Let me ask this then to continue the conversation about founding the nation. What type of role did Washington play during the Constitutional Convention, and where did he find himself more on when it came to the idea of Article II? Was he more on the side of the Anti-Federalists who were more hesitant of the powers in the executive branch, or did he find himself more on the side of the Federalists?
Well, I will say just very briefly, Washington's role was privately played in the convention, except on one very dramatic occasion. And I think that dramatic occasion actually responds to your question, though it has to do not with Article II, but Article I. And that's when at the end of the convention, he proposes that the rule for representation be made more democratic than the convention had agreed to do. And this was on the final day of the convention, when the whole document had been engrossed and was ready to be signed, and he nevertheless asked them to make a change, a substantial change in it. To do which, he stepped out from behind the dais, which he had not done before when in full convention, apologized, but explained what he wanted them to do. Then he stepped back behind the dais and allowed them to do it with unanimity, simply because he asked for it. So in that dramatic moment, we see him lifting up the profile of the legislature, which says something about, therefore, his attitude toward the executive. He saw these powers in balance. I think perhaps it was Dr. Morrison who said it before, but he saw a balance among the branches of government. And finally, we must remember the presidency was not defined in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It was defined by the administration of the government. Washington set the tone of the executive branch by his administration of the government, not by the bare provisions of Article II. That's what has created for us the true executive in the United States, of which we have lived with sometimes well and sometimes ill ever since.
I would love to dive deeper into that subject of not how Washington's assumed role may or may not have shaped Article II, but how did Washington's presidency shape Article II, both through his precedents he may have set and laws passed and signed during his time?
Yes.
Dr. Spaulding or Dr. Morrison, either one of you want to take that one?
Jeff, you're right about that.
Well, just to reiterate what's been said before by several of us, Washington is, yes, he's an executive by nature, but as Dr. Allen was just pointing out, he, in that one significant speech at the end of the convention, does uplift the role of the legislature and the democratic process. And we often forget, I think, that Washington spent 16 years in the Virginia legislature.
Yes.
Now, perhaps he was not the most active member, perhaps not there all the time, but that was, I think, a marvelous training ground for him. And when he assumed command of the so-called Continental Army, he understood how legislatures can be slow, they can be difficult to work with, they can be overly deliberative. And so, despite his great frustrations and justified frustrations at their inability to clothe his army and to feed his army and to pay his army,
yes,
he never, ever gave in to the temptation, which some of his officers wanted to do, to circumvent the legislature or to have a sort of coup d'etat or to demand their pay at the end of a bayonet. He always sublimated himself and his army to the legislative control, to the civil authorities. And I think that long training ground in the Virginia legislature was good training for him, and he drew upon that. Now, yes, please, go ahead, Doctor.
I just wanted to follow up on that because I think you're so right and it's so important. And I want to remind us all that Washington subordinated even things he dearly longed for to the authority of the legislature. He did that particularly in regard to slavery. This is what the letter to Dalby represents when he's protesting irregular action in Pennsylvania against the slaveholder. Not because he's defending the slaveholder. He says there, and it's clear, he's now come maturely to wish nothing more than the abolition of slavery. He labored in the Virginia Assembly to get them to do it legislatively. He was frustrated, but he accepted at the end of the day, as he said in the Dalby letter, this cannot be done unless it's done by legislative will. Now, not fiat,
right?
Nothing arbitrary, but legislative will. That's exceedingly important.
Right. No, but it also underscores the kind of we might call the transitional question, if you will. Remember, when he becomes commander in chief, there are some wonderful discussions when he becomes commander in chief in correspondence with Adams about the extent of his commission.
Yes.
And it's not completely clear. And remember, he is already on offensive military operations before the Declaration of Independence. He takes his Continental Army into New York without New York's permission or without the Congress's permission. That is, there's a fine line here between the role of commander of the army. His objective there was winning the army. Remember, he has the mayor of New York arrested prior to the Declaration and prior to the Constitution on the grounds of treason, which was not a legal category at the time because there was no nation.
Yes.
There's a fine line between that and transitioning. So I just think the defining thing here is how he took a situation in which he was the commander in every sense of that term. He personified the founding, but yet he used all of his authority, his moral authority and his political authority, to transition that his persona, in many ways, away from him to the Constitution itself. And I think we see that in his first inaugural, which is a beautiful shift, if you will, from him as the commander to the Constitution itself. So I think that underscores everything that's been said here. And then once you've gotten to that, it's the legislative authority. He's the proper role of the executive, but really he gets us to the point where constitutional government even exists. And in order to do that, he's granted the power of the Caesars twice, and he uses it, but he gives it back.
Yeah,
right. But he understands that when you're the commander in chief of the army, sometimes you actually have to do things as commander in chief. Which is outside, if you will, the four corners of constitutional government, but he put us within those four corners. And that's what his leadership and his statesmanship accomplishes.
I love that expression.
Well, Dr. Allen, would you like to say anything else on Washington's time in the presidency and what lasting effects that had on the office of the presidency?
You haven't time. But I will say this.
We do. We want to hear what you have to say.
I will say this. I recently reviewed a new book on Washington's cabinet, which was written under the inspiration of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Lincoln's team of rivals. And the author essentially attempted to show Washington is dealing with the same problem Lincoln was dealing with. And I pointed out in the review that was a very big mistake. For one thing, it didn't understand the purpose of Washington's delegating, and it didn't understand the sureness of his decision-making. He could have a cabinet which was in conflict with itself because he was confident in himself. Mm-hmm. And that's what set the tone for the government. That's what created the frustration in a Jefferson and many another person. But that's also what built the continuing relationship between Washington and Hamilton. Yes, he could bring anybody into his cabinet, practically speaking, because he was not going to lose control of his cabinet.
Right. There was that great, remember those, there's a series of letters when Hamilton and Jefferson really get bickering, but they're both still in the cabinet.
Yes.
And Washington writes them separate letters each, and they're very similar letters. So he clearly was writing at the same time. And he basically says, look, you guys can fight all you want, but you got to stay within the Constitution. And so calling each other monarchists and Francophiles or whatever it might, there's some things beyond the pale. So you're going to stay within my limits. Yes. That's exactly right.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Well, before we start to wrap things up, I wanted to see if there was anything else either one of you wanted to talk about when it comes to Article II and George Washington. Any closing thoughts on that topic?
Well, I'd like to make one, if I may, and it has to do with the foreign policy making of the president. And I believe that Washington really set the tone for future presidents in taking charge of foreign policy matters. In this sense, he does certainly sketch out for the infant nation a policy of isolation. As I understand him, he wants America to stay out of the interminable wars of Europe and the wars of religion that last for 30 years and 100 years and so on, so that this infant country that he had helped to father could grow up. And then, as he says in the farewell address and elsewhere, then it will be up to us how we posture ourselves toward belligerent nations. But issuing that proclamation of neutrality, for example, was a bold step to take, and setting a course of isolation for us, likewise bold. And I think one could argue that we followed that policy of Washington's. Certainly when Jefferson becomes president, he is even more isolationist than Washington. And some of the phrases that we tend to associate with Jefferson actually originate with Washington. No entangling alliances and things like that. And so one could say we follow George Washington's lead in foreign policy until 1947 or 1948, when we finally make a permanent alliance by joining NATO, for instance.
Almost significantly probably the United Nations.
Go ahead, Dr. Allen.
I was just going to say, or the United Nations.
Right.
I was just going to add, I think, you know, I generally agree with that. I think it probably goes too far. I don't think it was a policy of isolation. I think that's a miss, because that term carries a lot of baggage, especially once you get into the late, you know, 19th, early 20th century. Washington himself in farewell address, you know, talks about permanent alliances,
yes,
as being the problem, but entangling alliances is from Jefferson, as Jeffrey pointed out, which was a different policy. But also, you know, Washington makes very clear in the farewell address, what does he want? He wants command of our own fortunes.
Yes.
It's not isolation as qua isolation, although I take Jeffrey's point to be correct. But what he wants is us to be a nation founded that can control its own destiny. That's not the narrow sense of isolation many people think of when they hear the term. But it was clearly not the modern view of being out and about doing everything in the world that has also come to be commonplace as well.
And I might add, Matthew, that the French understood that. That's why they accuse the farewell address as the expression of Machiavellianism.
Right. Right.
And I agree with you completely. I don't think it actually was isolationist as we understand it in the contemporary sense. I think it was that we had to secure ourselves while we were weak sufficiently till we became strong enough to defy anybody who would challenge us.
Yeah, to determine war as we shall choose, as our own interest defined by justice, I think is the term he uses.
That is precisely
correct. In fact, he does use the phrase our justice too. Yeah, our interest tempered by our justice. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Because he sees that justice is an obligation for us. And it's not just an obligation in foreign relations. It's an obligation on citizenship. What is going to make this country work, make this constitution work, is a people, a self-governing people who are committed to the pursuit of justice in the world. I don't mean justice in the activist sense of trying to change the world, but I mean dealing justly with others.
Right, and that's precisely why Lincoln and other greats look to Washington. So on the one hand, yes, we can say that Washington didn't do that much and wasn't an example of a modern presidency. But on the other hand, he of course is the model, because he was a constitutionalist and understood his role as an executive in light of the larger thing. which is upholding yes. the Constitution itself.
So speaking of great character, as one of my final questions, I'll ask each of you to name, what is your favorite characteristic of George Washington?
Well, I guess I'll go first because I've already alluded to my answer to that question, which was laid out in, you know, I think perhaps even unintentionally in Jefferson's letter, where he says he's no Bacon, Newton, or Locke. And he has all the other characteristics about how he's the greatest horseman of the age. And he actually ends up complimenting Washington. But the center of it, he says he had this characteristic called prudence, yeah. which is, I think he's a wonderful example in the middle of kind of this supposed period of modernity of the world of John Locke and the Enlightenment thinkers. Washington is a wonderful example of a great man having the classical principles, and at the center of that is this virtue of prudence. Mm-hmm. And I think that his being executive by nature, but also his own humility and his own personal characteristics of how he presented himself and carried himself, you know, it is really a classical sense of the virtues. But the central one of the statesman is prudence, being able to understand the good, and he clearly imbibes and personifies the principles of the Revolution, but also a keen instinct for personal circumstances and the requirements of those circumstances. And he just represents that, not just in the founding, but really simply as a great statesman, a model of the prudent statesman.
Yeah, that's very well said. If I may go next, and I'd like to leave Dr. Allen the last word.
I
echo that about prudence, but I would say self-control. Washington was a man of great passion. He was a very passionate man. He had a volcanic temper, for example, that he had to learn to sublimate. And in our day and age, emotion, I think, is the great desideratum. You know, passion is a good word to us. It was a bad word to the ancients and to the men of Washington's time. So he learns to control himself, that volcanic temper, those passions which are strong by nature. And he is Aristotle's magnanimous man. He's the kind of example that he puts forth in the Nicomachean Ethics, for example. You learn a kind of second nature through doing, through practice, through habit. And Washington is a self-conscious person without being overly prideful, you know? And he's everything that he does is tailored, I think, to self-improvement, to self-education, to becoming the man he wanted to be, believed he should be, through self-control. That's one of the most admirable things about him, I believe.
Well, those are both powerful testimonies, and I suppose I'm going to have to confine myself to the one brief thing that I published, but I should at least say before that I answer this in the context of knowing that when George Washington was pressed to write his memoirs, his response, perhaps the only moment in all of his correspondence in which the veil of modesty slips, is that that will have to await the advent of some Homer.
Right.
Now, I say that the thing that really stands out for me is that he preferred justice to patriotism, for he understood ultimately patriotism as simply the amplification of partisanism. But justice is the substantive, the magnanimous, the ultimate claim upon his soul. And so that is to me, in the end, the founding virtue.
So I would just note for the record that the three of us have identified the moral virtues, the intellectual virtues, and in the case of prudence, the in-between virtue, if you will. So basically, he represents the whole array of all the virtues, and therefore is a magnanimous man.
Excellent.
I think we all agree on that. Well said, both of you.
I think that's a wonderful place for us to wrap up. I would just like to give each of you a second to say where people can learn more about you or find more information about your work.
Well, I can be accessed on the web, whether through MSU or my personal website, williambarclayallen.com.
And Dr. Morrison?
Well, I'm kind of a Luddite when it comes to technology and social media. I don't have any social media presence at all. But you can go to the Center for American Studies at my university, Christopher Newport University, where I'm a senior fellow, and there will be a brief biography of me. Likewise, at my federal government position as Director of Academics at the James Madison Foundation.
Perfect. And so my work, I'm at Hillsdale College, but I'm based at the Washington, D.C. campus, where I'm a dean of the graduate school there. So if you go to Hillsdale in D.C., there's information about me and some of our writings, but also we do have some social media if you're interested in following me or our work.
Well, thank you, Dr. Spalding, Dr. Morrison, and Dr. Allen for joining us today on another episode of the FedSoc Films Podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Our guests today were Dr. Matthew Spalding, the Vice President of Washington Operations at Hillsdale College, Dr. Jeffrey Morrison, Professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University, and Dr. W.B. Allen, Emeritus Dean and Professor at Michigan State University. You can check out the film American Cincinnatus on YouTube, Facebook, or fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films Podcast. As always, the Federal Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.